You're listening to a podcast from 702.
For staying with us this hour, I'm in conversation with Karen Morn, who's a specialist reporter for TESOL Black Star, as well as a contributor to Newsroom Africa. And we want you to be able to understand by 11 o'clock every single thing that you need to know in relation to the Jacob Zuma trial. Of course, big news with the attempt to have a permanent stay, I always want to say execution, of prosecution being declared by the court. That did not happen. What does that mean? How did the court decide that? Where to from here? So we talk about the present, what will happen tomorrow, and also looking back and reminding ourselves where have we come from with this particular case before also putting the wider political lens on this particular legal battle. Because law and politics, as you know, and mesh in South Africa in all sorts of fascinating ways. So sit back and listen and learn. If you do have a question, a comment, point of agreement, disagreement, you want to go, oh my God, things are really bad, give us a call and be part of the conversation throughout on 011-883-0702. Karen, good morning.
Hello.
It's wonderful seeing you.
It's wonderful seeing you.
Yeah, we haven't had you in studio in a while. Thank you so much for showing love for the Eusebius McKayser show.
Only love for the Eusebius McKayser.
Some person was asking, now we often make up titles. You see, you know, social analysts and political analysts being created left, right, and center, self-styled. One of my listeners was asking why, I don't know why they're asking this question, but let's answer it. Why is Karen a specialist reporter? What does that mean?
Well, I didn't give myself the title, guys. Like, you don't... No, it's just because I focus predominantly on legal stuff. And that's kind of, and I thank God for that every
also,
day. I've never been to an ANC conference. I've never covered anything vaguely political. I'm just in the courts and that's where I'm happy. So that's what I specialize
in. It's also
in.
A beautiful euphemism for old guys. It means she's been in the trenches for so long now. We could also say veteran reporter.
Listen, Wena, we are the same age, so don't even start with that nonsense.
Oh, my God. The day they call me veteran broadcaster, then I'm going to quit my
then
job.
We must just both.
Yeah, we leave that for people 10, 20 years older than you and me. But thank you so much for being part of this conversation. I think we're going to not quite do the from cradle to grave format today because our listeners are clever and they've listened to you before doing that with a trial. Some people might have run off to the coast like me if they are, you know, saddled with middle class problems and run away from the Highveld for 2 days. So why don't we start in the present? What were the nexus legal questions before the court on Friday? And we often only pay attention to the outcome of court processes rather than what lawyers call the ratio or the reasoning behind us. I'd like to understand that. It'll also help me be up to date with what's going on. And then we can talk about some of the wider and the historical issues.
Well, I think, you know, there were a number of different applications before the court on both sides of this thing, applications by the state to strike certain averments by Jacob Zuma and an attempt by him to get a letter written by Sean Abrams in 2018 into evidence, which, of course, the court dismissed. But fundamentally, it was about the way in which the prosecution of Jacob Zuma had been conducted. It's been a sort of stop-start thing, you know, in 2009. Various, you know, the most famous nexus point, of course, with the spy tapes recording the case being withdrawn. And really, this question of has his prosecution been characterized by undue and unreasonable delay? And the kind of delay that could have quite a profound kind of forensic prejudice on him in terms of his ability to sort of successfully defend himself. Coupled, of course, with his argument, which I think was one of the strongest ones that he made, that he should have been tried with his former financial advisor, Shabir Sheikh, when Sheikh was put on trial around 2004, because that would have allowed him to defend himself in the moment and allowed him to cross-examine Sheikh, which obviously now, having seen that Sheikh is completely discredited, is not really something that's available to him. So that was the pivotal question. Of course, Thales is the French arms company that's accused of essentially, you know, offering or being part of the scheme allegedly by Sheikh to ensure that Zuma got a 500,000 rand a year bribe in exchange for his protection from an arms deal investigation. They also brought an application to review Sean Abrams' decision to so-called reinstate the charges against them. And they also brought a permanent stay. But across the board, all of those cases being dismissed by the High Court.
Okay, that's very useful because I really want to slow it down. This is not even 101. This is summer school before you start university. Mm. So it wasn't only Jacob Zuma. This was also about the company.
Exactly. Remember, there's a long-running and convoluted history with Thales. I mean, it's had many different names, Thompson CSF, Tint. It was one of the companies that benefited quite significantly, I think, in the region of a few billion rand in the arms deal. And the allegation, and of course, Shabir Sheikh, you know, one of his companies was kind of a BEE component of that deal. And of course the allegation is that with Patricia de Lille coming out in parliament and saying that there was this dossier and the potential for an investigation, this company got, you know, extremely, concerned, and Sheikh essentially, offered or allegedly offered the services of Zuma, on the version of the state to try and, you know, prevent any kind of provide political protection, I think was the term that was used, against any potential arms deal inquiry.
Let's drill down into one of those elements. Firstly, this argument about a lot of time has lapsed, Your Honor, and that is the fault of the prosecutors, and therefore my rights enshrined in the Constitution to a speedy trial have already been annihilated to the point where it would be unjust to continue with this entire matter. Was that an argument that was canvassed both by former President Jacob Zuma and Thales, or did they have different tactics for why they want a permanent stay?
Well, Thales tended to have quite a kind of legalistic you know, application of around this issue of was it, you know, appropriate for him to reinstate the prosecution and the powers of the NDPP, which the court kind of just completely and substantively rejected. Interestingly enough, we never saw the representations that Thales had made to the NPA being put into the court record. So we don't know what exactly the nuts and bolts of their particular defense are. I mean, they've, you know, had a very strange history with the matter. We know that, for instance, Elaine Tetart at one stage, the charges getting withdrawn against Thales on the basis that he provided an affidavit basically saying that he was the author of the so-called encrypted facts, which was established in the trial of Shabir Sheikh to be evidence that this bribe was solicited and accepted. He provides an affidavit saying that, look, I'm the author of this fax. And then, you know, a few days later, weeks later, says, no, you know, it was just a rough draft. It cannot be, you know, I crumpled it up and threw it in the bin. And then obviously someone gave it to the NPA. So completely reversed the position. But despite that, the NPA still made good on its promise to withdraw the charges against it. But I think for Jacob Zuma, and there has been a problematic history to this case. I mean, I know the court in this matter said basically Bulelani Ngcuka was justified in the decision that he made to not prosecute Shabir Sheikh because, I mean, to not prosecute Jacob Zuma alongside Shabir Sheikh. Because as the court said, you know, they quoted the Harams decision in the Nicholson ruling where they said, you know, just because you have prima facie evidence, you know, in a corruption matter, you know, it's a far more complex thing. You know, you're not necessarily going to be able to prove that there was intentionality on the part of the person who may have accepted the alleged bribe. There's so many other nexus points. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he made an appropriate decision, even though he went against the wishes of his then, of his prosecutors, Billy Downer and Advocate Ferreira. But I think that's something that.
But that makes that makes conceptual sense. It also makes practical sense, because I may begin my efforts to corrupt you, but we may not yet have a corrupt meeting of the minds, and so at least in theory, if someone is investigating the two of us, they may be ready to pounce on me and put me before a court of law, but wait for a little bit more to make sure that also there's a slam dunk against you, understanding what it is that I'm doing when I go and buy you some clothes at Nelson Mandela Square. Notwithstanding Downer's thinking that they were ready. Obviously, there were internal disagreement, but I can see why that might be the case. So Does this mean that the court, and here I'm going to be at your mercy, was suggesting that one cannot reasonably accuse the prosecutorial authority of malafides in relation to this long timeline that have prevented Jacob Zuma from having the substantive issues being ventilated, the actual claims of corruption? How did the court deal with, which is really, when all is said and done, Jacob is basically saying, look, if these guys wanted to put me on trial for corruption, they could have done so donkeys years ago.
Mm. The interesting thing with this is that the judgment sort of says, doesn't say, because this NPA, of course, said Jacob Zuma was to blame for most of the.
Yes.
The court it just says this was a systemic thing.
Okay, so it's agnostic on who's
to
be blamed.
Yes, it's agnostic. And I think that was very important because there has been this rhetoric around Jacob Zuma that, you know, he's just the king
of
delays.
You've made your own bed.
But the court was extremely careful to say, well, actually, you know, no, because his argument has always been, well, I have the right in a constitutional democracy to, you know, if I feel that you illegally obtained warrants to search and seize my premises, I can challenge that. If I feel that it's not appropriate that you obtain evidence from Mauritius, you know, the so-called original of the facts, etc., I can challenge that in court. And I think the court was, and I think it's appropriate. I think that, you know, it can be a bit of a fine point to say that someone wasn't entitled to utilize the mechanisms of the law. But Jacob Zuma is in this incredible situation where, as a consequence of all those judgments that were accumulated in the path to where we find ourselves now, this judgment was essentially constructed out of all the rulings previously given against him. Mm. So, you know, the court here on the Bulelani Nguka issue, which was a pivotal thing for Jacob Zuma. And I know he still believes that Nguka, because of everything that came subsequently with the spy tapes recordings, with the decision around Sheikh, etc., he very much believes that there was malafides. And the court relying on the Harams judgment, which I think was given 2008, 2009, I mean, this is a decade ago, to say essentially that, like, the decision that Nguka made at that time was appropriate, and they're using that rationality from a decade ago to essentially say, you know, this was a legitimate decision. I don't know what Jacob Zuma's counsel will do with that. And I've had very fascinating conversations with people like James Grant, particularly on this issue of what Harams said about, it doesn't matter if a prosecution is politically, is motivated improperly.
Yeah, we're going to come to that. That's one of my favorite.
I mean, I find that one of the most interesting,
one of my favorite points of law. Because that's also where the law intersects with politics in a really beautiful way. And there are different jurisdictions around the world that view so-called wicked prosecutorial motives differently to how we do. But we've got case law that can help us out. You can disagree with the case law, but it is what it is. We'll come to that a little bit later. I want to just fast forward on one other part of Friday. Notwithstanding, which is really fascinating to me, that you are saying the court was essentially agnostic about whose individual action is responsible for the time delay, that it is systemic in the nature of legal proceedings, that things took this long, doesn't mean you're not going to be having your day in court, Mr. Zuma. But he didn't just lose the case and Thales. They also had punitive cost orders. And you and I have spoken before, under what circumstances the court do that?
Well, I mean, this is the issue. I mean, I think that they overwhelmingly now we have seen a legal tendency, a completely strong tendency coming from the courts that started, I think, with the state capture matter, started with the Nkasana matter, where, you know, adverse costs orders, personal costs orders are now routinely made against the former president. Now he's in a situation where, as a consequence of another ruling given against him, he no longer has access to state funding of his legal fees.
Good.
He has to reimburse 16 million rand, it estimated, that's already been sent on this case, you know, while fighting off a VBS attempt to, you know, to potentially repossess his home. And, you know, the consequence of a punitive costs order in the relation to that, you know, that's also a way in which I think there's going to be, you know, now where previously he may have had the ability to say, what are my legal options? What can I do? Can I appeal this? He's now so painted into such a firm corner, financially speaking, that I honestly don't know what he's going to do. I mean, a lot of people say to me, do you think he'll appeal? What will he do? with what money? And with what money will he defend himself if he goes on a trial? So in the context of that, this money issue is pretty pivotal.
We've got to take our first break. As we do so, does anyone know? I suppose it's an impossible question. Whether he's got money or whether he's as indigent as Dudu, or does he still have sugar daddies?
I don't. My impression is not. I mean, there's a lot of money there. And from knowing, you know, some having some insight into, for instance, the
Was he at the court the other day?
He wasn't at the court, but okay. He will be. No, he was at the court on or during the hearing. He came in
there. Did he look disheveled or still with his shoes shone?
Well, you know, he came in. It was remarkable because it was the exact same courtroom where Judge Herbert Nsamung found in favor of him. It was the exact same courtroom where Chris Nicholson had found in favor. And it was like startling for me because I had an experience as a young journalist being in this thronged courtroom where, you know, Vavi, Fikile and Balula, you know, he had this wealth of supporters. People were there. You know, it was a different dimension of him many years later, now in his current situation. Very small crowd. Very, very different experience.
It sounds like a tale of two courts and the opening scene of a book. I'm just going to leave it there.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 for the curious.
25 minutes after 10, if you've just joined us, I'm in conversation with veteran legal reporter Karen Moore.
Oh, no, you did it.
Who's with us until 11. I can see from social media responses you are, like me, enthralled by the granularity of her explanations and the institutional memory. If you want to ask a question, again, you know, when it comes to our, especially on a Monday, we've got into a rhythm called it sort of explainer journalism. No such thing as a dumb question. We want you to be informed, understand that terminology we're banding about. Give us a call, or just specific aspects of the Jacob Zuma corruption case. We'll see whether we can help you out. And where we can't, we in turn ask the experts and we'll bring other ones on. 011-883-0702. 011-883-0702. The lines are open all the way until 11 o'clock. Karen, can we talk a little bit about an aspect here? Let's get into some more interesting, nerdish detail. So part of the order includes things that Jacob Zuma had in the affidavit that the NPA wanted to strike out because it's vexatious. And what do those terms mean in law? And what were they trying to get struck out and why?
Well, essentially what happened was, you know, the sting of that whole thing was kind of taken out of it because Jacob Zuma's advocate, Musi Sekakane, said, look, I don't really want to be fighting and arguing over this. So there was an agreement between the parties that the things that Jacob Zuma had said in relation to Billy Downer, who's the prosecutor who's been prosecuted Sheikh successfully and then subsequently prosecuted him. He essentially said that he believed that Billy Downer was driven by his hatred of him, to paraphrase. And he also suggested that he longed for the era of apartheid prosecutions where, you know, the constitutional rights of the person accused would be sort of, you know, that there weren't any kind of aspect of what would happen. And of course, Billy Downer then filing a subsequent response to that and saying, you know, that this it was vexatious, scandalous. So vexatious is really about, you know, stuff that's not necessarily grounded in fact, but is ultimately almost insulting.
So it's slanderous and a waste of time as well.
Exactly. And scandalous, obviously. So the court ultimately not needing necessarily to make a ruling on that, but simply saying that this issue was, and I think that was wise by Sekakane. I think it would have just added more drama to the whole mix. But essentially the court saying, granting that order, which was reached by agreement between the state and the
defense. Were they trying their luck? Because Musi Sekakane is a senior counsel. I've got enormous respect for him.
Yeah.
He's a fascinating lawyer. And at times, and we saw this also at the Zondo Commission, it's almost as if, and I'm sure Musi wouldn't on the record agree to this, but I'd fancy my chances of getting to concede off the record. Almost as if he knew that on narrow legal issues, he's going to lose, but there's a certain political drama, which is where the law intersects with politics, where you know you say certain things and you make certain claims, even about whether your client will get a fair hearing in front of the Zondo Commission, or here to try and sneak into the archival record certain letters and certain claims about Downer that will live long after Jacob Zuma is in prison. Is that an attempt to play politics and try your luck because you understand that what's at play here, as important as it is, isn't only the question of is Zuma corrupt and should he be in orange overalls, but also a broader question in relation to his political biography?
Well, you are about to break for news, and I think that I am going to answer this, but I need time, and I don't want to. I mean, I think that you raise points.
Okay, let's. Yeah, we that's will, a we nice, will, juicy question. Go put the kettle on.
Put the kettle on, guys.
Eusebius McKaiser. Eusebius McKaiser. On 702.
27 minutes before 11 o'clock, we're talking about Jacob Zuma having lost his latest attempt to try and kick for touch in the matter of corruption cases stacked up against him now since 1999. That is originally how far back it goes, right? What? How far do we go back with this timeline?
The original allegations, the relationship between him and Sheikh, I think, started around 1995.
Okay.
And then that timeline extended. Mm. But the
I'm still in high school.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and that's what's going to be fascinating when this case does eventually go on trial. Is, I mean, Jacob Zuma has raised the issue. Like, I can't remember a lot of these things that, you know, were raised, and I'm not sure what entirely happened. And, you know, if it does actually get going, you're talking about events in many respects that played out like over three decades ago.
Let's tackle the question we had framed before news headlines, which is whether Jacob Zuma's lawyer and lawyers are also cognizant of the fact that when he steps into either the court or a judicial commission of inquiry, that these processes are simultaneously legalistic but also socio-political.
I think the thing is that I've got enormous respect for Muzisi Kakane, and I think that he genuinely believes that there have been constitutional problems with what has happened with Jacob Zuma. And I don't for one minute question that he is not the kind of person that seeks to manipulate a process in a political way. He's got a huge sense of his own of integrity. And he has, you know, made a habit. Remember when Julius Malema was on the outs with the Youth League, he was representing him. He's always had this pathology of sort of taking on the cases and, you know, representing Mkhwebane at the moment in that Gordon, not in the Gordon matter, in the Ramaphosa matter. So taking on the causes of people who are very much kind of pushed to the outskirts of the political landscape. But yeah, I mean, and Jacob Zuma, I mean, I think the question assumes that, you know, lawyers can control what Jacob Zuma may do or say. Mm. The one thing that was fascinating was before the Zondo Commission, of course, we saw that exchange of correspondence between Zuma's lawyers and the lawyers for the inquiry, where they were like, you know, we need to have an idea of what you're going to ask him, because otherwise we're not sure, you know, how he's going to react. And we saw what happened. Mm. That was that there was no statement before Jacob Zuma. He came in there and he said what he wanted to say. And he is someone who increasingly just speaks off the cuff and articulates a lot of things that may seem quite difficult to believe, like the, you know, the using a someone at a suicide bomber at a Maskandi concert to kill you. A lot of this stuff is quite over the top, but it does seem that there is a genuinely held belief there. And I think that, you know, there is a sense as he has been pushed further and further into this corner that he's become a person who actually has nothing left to lose. Mm-hmm. So if this trial does go ahead, when he returns to the Zondo inquiry, I think there's a huge sense of like, what must happen now? Mm. You know, you just don't know. I mean, I can't predict any of it.
Rams, we're going to come to your question in a second. Just hold on for me, calling us from Polokwane. But let's take a couple of ones from social media and just handle them very quickly, if we can. Some of them are a bit complicated. Here's one from someone who asks on Twitter, Karen, what are the lawyers telling Zuma on these cases? Look, we could do an entire segment about exactly what Karen has just alluded to, relationships between lawyers and clients. I think there's a whole piece of radio or television to be done there. That's really, really interesting. A bit like our relationships with our therapists and with our medical doctors as well. But one can only speculate there unless you have off-the-record discussions. For example, it'll be really interesting to know, as a matter of fact, whether Zuma has for years been told, dude, just get on with the main business. But lawyers, as they will tell you, are creatures of instruction. I've been instructed by my client to do A, B, C, D.
I think the thing is that you obviously, as a lawyer, know that there are particular options available to your client. You advise them on these are the options, these are the implications of your options, but you must ultimately make the decision. And Jacob Zuma is, you know, when I've spoken to him about the case, he has a deep understanding of what's happened. He's by no means a stupid man at all. And he has a quite profound degree of political consciousness, obviously, but also legal awareness. And, you know, I think that he makes these decisions very much on his own. But I mean, you know, there will be a question mark around a lot of the decisions that were made to litigate in the way that they did, particularly given the consequences that he now personally must face, the money that he has to pay back, the way in which these judgments have now been used against him to construct this ruling that effectively now forces him to go on trial.
Lungisa Mnyandu wants to know, are we still paying for his legal fees? I'll tag on a question that we've tried to tackle, you and I, before. I think you've written on it. Are we still keeping decent tabs on how much it has cost historically the taxpayer thus far?
We are no longer paying his legal fees. The North Gauteng High Court made a ruling that him relying on certain provisions of the state attorney's legislation was simply inappropriate, and that you know, he couldn't get legal funding. The court also ordering that he pay back 16.7 million rand, which I think was the amount that the President Cyril Ramaphosa provided to the court in terms of how much money had actually been spent thus far. He is seeking to appeal that decision in the Supreme Court of Appeal, but as yet, no date for that hearing has been set.
Grams, good morning. Thank you for calling in.
Good morning, Eusebius.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I wanted to just ask Karen and your guest today, and thank you for the opportunity, that does the court actually address the minutiae of arguments that Jacob Zuma raises? For example, he said so many times he wants his day in court. Does the court actually say, no, you had your day in court, or you were given the opportunity, and therefore you are out of order? Does the court, for example, address the argument that he makes around the waste of time? In other words, in detail, do they say, no, but you had this opportunity, you had this opportunity, this opportunity? I'm really interested in the smaller little things in the arguments that Jacob Zuma makes.
Okay, let's take this in turn, right? So, firstly, if you want to be pretentious over lunch, Rams, lawyers refer to something called obiter dicta, which is just Latin for remarks made by the court that are not strictly speaking part of the adjudication process, but it's them making comment. In the history of the various cases, have they ever ventured to basically say to this guy, okay, now that I'm done with the main part of the judgment, Mr. Zuma, for sake, you've been wanting your day in the court, can you stop it?
Well, there was an interesting moment, which I think if this matter is appealed will be something that the defense will choose to ventilate or may ventilate, where the court actually says that the seriousness of the charges that Zuma faces, you know, basically means that he needs to go on trial, that, you know, all these issues around, the issue of delay, the issue of potential prosecutorial interference, et cetera, cannot outweigh the kind of seriousness, of the charges that he faces. And, you know, that's again, you know, the court, What's fascinating with this is that this is essentially amalgamation. In the beginning of the judgment, the judgment is 76 pages long, and I would urge people to read it. It is freely available. One of the things, they literally track the entire history of the Jacob Zuma matter from the early times of Sheikh, the Bulelani Ngoka decision, the Vusi Pikoli decision, the spy tapes, etc., 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 etc. And they go through it, and then right at the end, they sort of give their evaluation, but they rely very heavily on these pre-existing judgments. And we know, for instance, in the spy tapes matter, the High Court saying, emphasizing this principle of equality before the law, and saying that, you know, Mshe's decision in terms of the spy tapes didn't take into account that principle that everyone is equal before the law, everyone must be treated equally. Of course, Zuma would argue that he hasn't been treated equally, that had he had been treated equally, he would have gone to trial with Sheikh, you know, he would have allowed back then to be able to defend himself in a far more effective way, et cetera, et cetera. And that issue around my day in court, he said that on his version on the time, at the time, of the Sheikh matter, where he was saying, well, you know, I need to, and when he was originally charged, and then we saw the NPA subsequently doing all those raids on his properties because they discovered through the course of the Sheikh trial that the initial corruption that they suspected was in fact far greater. It had gone from about 1.5 million rand to 4.5 million rand. Potentially, and that they wanted to then do raids on his properties. He then challenged the raids, et cetera, et cetera. That caused a whole delay. And it was around that time that he was saying this stuff about his day in court. He's now saying, listen, this case is so tainted, so delayed, you know, just like drop it. But the court ultimately relying on all these sort of like the little skeletons that have been left behind in this trail to say no.
It sounds
to
me like it's a very impressive judgment. I haven't read it yet. You'll share it with me immediately and then I can do my own homework, because it's very easy to say, oh, this thing is just tainted, let's just call it a day.
Mm.
But the job of good legal adjudication is to say, no. I get that you want to say that this thing feels odious because it's dragged on. But we have to be clinically analytical, A, about the timeline and what has gone on before. And we've got to make a judgment call based on the facts that have been established in the record and that are before us. And so we're not going to fall for this. There's an aura of taintedness, which is a very convenient, generalized description of the case. But a good legal adjudicator, which a decent magistrate or judge should be, they should be able to just dispassionately look at exactly the timeline that you're talking about.
Well, the thing that I find interesting, and I'm not 100%, I mean, I've had conversations with some of the advocates, that point that I raised earlier, about this issue of improper motive.
Exactly the issue I want to come to. Yeah. Let's tackle it right now.
You know, remember the Chris Nicholson ruling? Basically, Jacob Zuma had gone to court and said that it was improper that the state reinstated the charges against him after Msimang struck the matter from the roll, because the state was awaiting all the results of these, these court challenges to the warrants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because that would ultimately impact on what evidence they could use against Zuma. So Msimang strikes a case from the roll. It's then reinstated. And Jacob Zuma says, no, I should have been given the right to make representations about why this case should not continue. And Nicholson goes further and says, this is clearly evidence of a massive political conspiracy involving supporters of President Mbeki. And Mbeki gets removed on the basis of that judgment. The SCA, Mbeki gets removed. And then what happens is that the SCA turns around and says, well, just because a prosecution has been brought for an improper purpose doesn't mean that the prosecution cannot continue. It's really a question of is there a case to answer? And has there been interference with the evidence to construct a case that doesn't exist? If that's the case, then that's a different story. But the court here is saying there's no attack by Zuma on the merits of the case. It's really about the motive. And that was one of the issues, you know, in many respects, I think the NPA may have got off a lot lighter than, more lightly than we would have assumed, because the NPA has also got profound responsibility in this debacle over this whole thing, because there was manifestly a kind of culture of political expedience within that environment, one way or the other. We do know that, you know, Muka had a certain, you know, sensibility when it came to Mbeki. And the court has simply accepted, you know, that he had the right to make the decisions that he did.
But it's one of those, I mean, there are two issues here, right? There's one factual question for, from a point of view of public information and education, which is that issue legally still a live issue? I want you to answer that. Then the second issue, which is something where both lawyers and non-lawyers can reasonably disagree on the open question. And the open question is whether a wicked, and by wicked I don't mean morally wicked, it's just in a legal term, a wicked motive should be the end of a case being pursued by any prosecutorial authority the world over. Now, I don't know the answer to the first one, but I thought that the judgment had settled the matter, that in our law, it is not enough, right? But the second issue, I mean, and I'd love your opinion on it, actually, and listeners who are listening. There are jurisdictions around the world where there's, where the logic goes something like this for why you should care about the motive of the district attorney or the prosecutorial authority, that it undermines the overall integrity of the legal system if people were able to initiate or pursue cases because they want to get back at someone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that used to be my initial view. And it was just a leftover view that I had from watching way too many years of LA law as a kid. But after reading the South African case law, I'm more convinced now that if the following two things can be guaranteed about Jacob Zuma, then the man must face the charges tomorrow morning without putting up another fight. Number one, the right to a fair trial, insofar as you will be dispassionately judged on the basis of the evidence before the court. Can that be guaranteed? If the answer is yes, tick it. Number two, is there a case to be answered in the opinion of the folks that have been working on the case, Downer et al.? And the answer is yes. Then you must face the music. It doesn't, anything else for me becomes extraneous.
Well, I mean, that's the thing that the court ultimately said. It said, you know, there is no attack on the merits of this prosecution. There's no attack on the evidence. And what makes things more difficult for Zuma, of course, is that Shabir Sheikh was convicted of corrupting him.
Exactly.
In judgments that withstood multiple attempts at appeal. Of course, the Harem's judgment also saying that just because you prove corruption against one person doesn't necessarily imply that you will prove against another. But certainly in terms of Sheikh, you know, the court ultimately finding that there was an intent to corrupt, and that was perpetuated with him, and of course, you know, there are difficulties with that for Zuma now.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 for the curious.
8 minutes before 11 o'clock, I want to expand the conversation beyond Zuma in the time that we have left with Karen Morn, and we're talking about the Jacob Zuma trial. There was a really, really good interview the other night that I happened to catch on ENCA between former ANC MP and someone who's now become a global authority on corruption, particularly in relation to odious arms deal. And that's, of course, Andrew Feinstein. And he was speaking to my Prime Media colleague who works also as a broadcaster at ENCA, Thembekile Mokgototo, who asked him an excellent question, whether beyond Jacob Zuma finally seeing his day in court, there are other actors in the history of this entire part of our post-democratic blight, the first major blight on our democracy, where the NPA should start and everyone else in the criminal justice system investigating. And he asked him very pointedly even about, former President Thabo Mbeki. And I was waiting on my couch with bated breath for the authoritative Andrew Feinstein to give an opinion. And Andrew said, yeah, I mean, it's proper for Jacob to finally see his comeuppance, legally speaking. But actually, there are an incredible number of individuals, some still in prominent positions in business, some still in government, some required and called upon left, right, and center to give memorial lectures here, there, and everywhere else with apparent moral authority that are hugely implicated in the hot mess of the various kinds of grand corruption we've seen since 1994. But Jacob Zuma, because he's so eminently unlikable, we've almost reduced the sins of incumbency to Jacob Zuma. Reflect on that for me, Karen, and how important it is that even your faves may yet have to be seen. And I can think of some names. I mean, some of them have passed on, your Joe Medesis. Others have been middlemen who you will find at tashes in Morningside with their posh cars on a Saturday morning.
Or at meetings with to design a Zuma and BBC Jonas. Yeah, exactly.
And they are just
where there is profound going about their business. Yeah. No, I think that's a very, very valuable point. And I think that's one of the, you know, one has to be very wary of retreating into the ambit of whataboutery, because it's not effective. I mean, there is a strong case against Jacob Zuma, but I mean, you know, and he will have to, I mean, ultimately his lawyers will have to make a decision about, you know, what happens there. But one of the most interesting aspects of the Sheikh case was that one of the pivotal pieces of evidence that was used against Sheikh was a letter signed by Jacob Zuma that was sent to the head of SCOPA at the time, Gavin Woods, to essentially say that the SIU should not investigate the arms deal. Because the SIU, of course, had the ability to recover money. And so it was quite a threat, you know, and the state used that as part of its argument to show that Jacob Zuma had offered some form of political protection to Thales. But subsequently, we saw Zuma, you know, my understanding is that, and I actually think he may have even said this in his papers, that it was in fact Thabo Mbeki who wrote that letter. And he simply signed it because he was in the position to do so. So this pivotal piece of evidence that was used to show that he politically protected Thales, actually, in fact, showed a degree of involvement by Mbeki and certain senior people in the ANC to stop the SIU from properly investigating and potentially recouping the billions of rands that were spent on an arms deal that we manifestly did not need. And the arms deal was a precursor to what the sort of endemic levels of corruption and lack of accountability for that corruption that subsequently emanated in all kind of aspects of public life in South Africa. So it was the cold that turned into pneumonia. You know, it was something that really, like, something that permeates us even today. Will people go on trial? I very much doubt it. And I think that Zuma will probably be the last of these kind of prosecutions. We know there was the prosecution of Tony Ngeni in terms of the cars. Chippy Sheikh has a case to answer, I think. Fanit Longwana, we know that European authorities at one stage the state pursuing, you know, raiding his properties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know at this stage whether there would be appetite from the NPA to pursue cases that are so long dormant, particularly given that the sort of follow through of a lot of these matters in terms of these so-called state capture cases, VBS, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are happening now. And South Africans are just hungry for some kind of current prosecution to all of the manifest issues that are plaguing our society now.
Well, if Jacob Zuma is part of a nexus of people, many of whom are assumed to be completely beyond moral reproach, he may yet drop some names as he has.
Oh, absolutely. I don't doubt that for a second. And I think that's the thing, is that he has, if he goes on trial, and that's a big if, we don't know what's going to play out from here forward. But if he does, this man has nothing left to lose. And, you know, he's very much been sort of put out into the wilderness. And he is in a very desperate situation. And I think that, you know, as we've seen before, when he gets pushed into a corner, that's when the claws come out in a big way.
30 seconds. What is tomorrow about?
Essentially, he's going to arrive in court. We'll find out tomorrow. Is he going to appeal? Is he going to ask for a postponement so he can consider his options? Or, in the absence of an appeal, we should see a date set for a trial. I think the state had said it would be ready to proceed as early as next month.
Karen Morn, specialist reporter for TESOL Black Star and contributor to Newsroom Africa. Thank you so much for your excellence and spending an hour with us.
Thank you for having me.